welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. Today we'll look at a number of subjects in the news. We'll begin in a moment and talk about corporate crime and the extent to which it is really a problem in this country, and how much Martha Stewart being tossed to the wolves is a distraction from her crimes being relatively trivial compared to the politically connected corporate criminals. We'll also talk about both Enron and, of course, Halliburton in this context. And we'll be speaking with Charles Cray, who's the policy analyst and the director of the Center for Corporate Policy. Then talk with Hussein Haqqani, who's a leading journalist, diplomat, and former advisor to Pakistan's prime ministers, Nawaz Sharif and Benazir Bhutto. And we'll be talking to him about the possibility that a deal was struck between General Musharraf, the Pakistani dictator, and George W. Bush in terms of you get Osama and I'll forgive you for selling nukes to Libya, Iran, and North Korea. So we'll be talking to Hussein Haqqani about that. And then in the third segment of the hour, we'll talk with Dr. Robert Maguire, who is the Director of Programs in International Affairs at Trinity College. And he's probably the country's leading expert on Haiti. He speaks Creole. He spent many, many years there. He worked initially with the Peace Corps and then with the Department of State in Haiti. And he testified this week before a House committee where Bush administration's point man on Haiti, Roger Noriega, testified. And members of the Black Caucus were also present at that testimony. And it was quite contentious. And we're talking to him about his testimony. And then in the second hour, we'll talk with Dr. Jeffrey Sachs, who also testified to these hearings on Haiti, and he is a director of the Earth Institute at Columbia University, and he's a special advisor to United Nations Secretary General Kofi Annan. Also, Ira Kurzban, Aristide's attorney, will call in the second hour, along with phone calls from the audience. So we'll be talking about international development with Jeffrey Sachs, since he was involved in the transitions of the economies of Poland and the Soviet Union into what I guess we'll find out more about how he would want to characterize the Soviet economy today. And he again was his testimony before the House was quite contentious, and the Republicans tried to shut him down. So we'll be talking, be having calls with Jeff Sachs in the second hour. Charles Cray, you with me?
Yes.
Let me again introduce you. Charles Cray, you're a policy analyst and the director of the Center for Corporate Policy in Washington, D.C. And obviously, in fact, in the president's new campaign commercials that he's just put out, along with references to 9/11, which some people object to, he also refers to the slings and arrows of outrageous misfortune that he had to deal with, not just 9/11, but also corporate crime. However, it does seem that Martha Stewart's conviction this week is relatively trivial compared to the fact that, for example, Kenneth Lay took the economy down for $400 billion, and he was George W. Bush's biggest single contributor to his entire political career, a close friend and confidant, and somehow he's free as a bird, and this hardworking, self-made woman is going to do time.
Well, I think the problem here is that some prosecutors are suggesting that this is a signal about corporate greed, when in fact this was basically a personal stock sale and had nothing to do with the accounting fraud and systemic corporate crime issues that we saw in the tidal wave of corporate crime and fraud a couple years ago. So there's a real conflation and confusion of issues going on here.
Well, I think that was reflected in the interviews following her convictions by an African-American gentleman who was on the jury, and he clearly talked about class warfare and felt this was, that they were striking a blow against the greedy wealthy class. But it seems to me that this gentleman's ire was quite misguided. She is, I don't think, is really much of a target in that. We're talking about $40,000 all told, compared to $400 billion.
Well, I think it should be said that Martha Stewart, you know, broke the law. She basically committed inside trading, apparently, but she was only convicted for misleading SEC investigators and committing conspiracy and obstructing the investigation. She herself was a former broker, so she pretty much knew the rules on trading. And, you know, she tried to delete the phone call records to her broker's office. So she clearly violated the law. But you talk to anybody who works on Wall Street, you know, it's not like this was unusual.
Let's go back to Harkin Energy with George W. Bush.
Well, sure.
Didn't he, his failure to inform the SEC of the sale of stock, isn't that a far more serious crime than what she's caught with? And he wasn't, the SEC didn't do anything except, you know, he just sort of said, oh, shucks, I forgot. And,
well,
you know,
they did investigate, but the problem was that with Bush's case is that the day after the SEC closed the original investigation, and this was under his father's administration, his lawyers gave the SEC the memo that showed, this was a memo that the lawyers for Harkin had written to the board members saying that if you have any adverse information about this company, in other words, if you know that it's going down, you should not sell your stock. This was given to him 2 weeks before he sold. They gave that memo to the SEC the day after they closed the investigation. They refused to reopen the investigation. Bush, you know, did all sorts of things at Harkin that he was denouncing corporate executives in his speech on Wall Street back in 2002, and when in that speech when he signed the Sarbanes-Oxley bill. So there's a lot of obvious hypocrisy here at the top.
Well, give us a sense, Charles Cray, of the magnitude of corporate crime in the United States.
Well, we saw this, tidal wave of accounting fraud that affected hundreds of companies, basically contributed to, the market's losing about half of its peak value, although the bubble burst before the accounting frauds came in. But every survey that's been conducted going back to basically 1950 demonstrates that corporate crime is pervasive. And we're not just talking about the financial crimes and accounting fraud that we saw in recent years that got a lot of attention, arguably because investors were hurt and investors are more important than others, like, for instance, the environment or workers. I mean, every year, according to OSHA standard or OSHA investigations and other reports, tens of thousands of workers die from workplace manslaughter and lack of safety at work, but you don't have a criminal sanction against corporations when workers die. The average penalty under the OSHA rules for a corporation when someone dies is about $910. So talk about class warfare. There's an aspect to corporate crime which penalizes the types of crime that harm the rich the most. That's why there's so much attention to accounting fraud and financial crime, because there are other people who have a lot of money whose interests are damaged. Those are hard crimes to prosecute, of course. That's why it's hard to get at the people like Ken Lay. They use the corporate forum to insulate themselves, and there's all sorts of sort of Byzantine problems in the corporate organizational structure that protect them, whether it's, you know, limited liability or the corporate governance checks and balances.
But the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, for example, criminologist Jeffrey Reimer estimate that the total cost of white-collar crime in 1997 was $338 billion, which is 80 times more than the total amount stolen in all thefts reported by the FBI that year.
Right. The FBI doesn't even track corporate crime the way they track, for instance, street crime. Every year they issue an annual Crime in America report that gathers data from local law enforcement agencies and tells you how many murders, robberies, larceny, auto theft, etc. there are. And if you look at those statistics compared to what we know about corporate crime, basically, for instance, theft, larceny, and all the other forms of robbery, amount to, or in 2001, if you look at the FBI's annual report, they amounted to less than the value of Enron stock that was lost, that investors lost from its peak, about $60 billion.
So the FBI reports all crime except the crime that is 80 times greater than the common theft that they, in car theft.
They might collect some of the data here and there. The problem is that a lot of the data is dispersed in different agencies, and nobody, either the FBI Office of Management and Budget, nobody gathers this data in one place so that we can analyze the trends, look for the worst sectors that might have the worst problems, and begin to, you know, start increasing pressure for enforcement in those areas. There's none of that sort of systemic analysis. They established in the 1990s a division of a cybercrime division, where they actually have these sort of SWAT groups that go out when there's a serious cybercrime. And arguably there are good reasons for that, including national security reasons, to have a cybercrime division. But, you know, we saw back after the SNL scandals, there was a proposal made by Senator Graham and Senator Kerry, actually, to establish a financial crimes unit in the Justice Department under President Bush 1, and nobody ever acted on that. Neither has anybody done that after the recent round with Enron, et cetera. All we saw was this Potemkin Village-style corporate fraud task force that Bush set up, which basically was an aggregation of existing bureaucrats without any increased budget or staff.
Again, let me remind the audience, if I may, I'm speaking with Charles Craze, a policy analyst and director of the Center for Corporate Policy. We're talking about corporate crime and trying to get some proportionality here in terms of Martha Stewart being a visible scapegoat for so much more corporate crime, so much more serious than what she's charged with. And I'm wondering here whether or not this is a politically motivated distraction, because the core support for George W. Bush, the Christian coalition, the Christian fundamentalists, they and the Baptists, they hate her because she's basically telling women that you can make, you can be self-made, you can make, you know, your own fortune, your own way. You don't have to be locked into the house. In fact, you could make virtues out of housework instead of being prisoners of your husbands and being servile to them, which is the mandate of the Christian right. And so she's not popular with Bush's core people, but she's also gives money to the Democratic Party and is a Democrat. So is there any, my suspicions here founded that perhaps this is a politically motivated sacrifice? Because
I don't know. I think they may be reading too much into it, because I think the kind of crime here that we're talking about, if you talk to federal prosecutors, is much easier to prosecute than the complicated forms of corporate crime and fraud that we've seen in other instances. I'll give you another example. There's a lot of companies that, many of them involved in the accounting fraud, that have essentially been either self-reported or been caught for bribery of foreign officials. And in one case, for instance, the IRS discovered this information in a review of Enron, and literally gave all the evidence to the Justice Department and SEC, who share enforcement authority over what's called the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act, which abolishes and penalizes bribery of foreign officials. And they did nothing with that information, according to a Senate investigative committee.
Get similar information about Halliburton's activities in Nigeria in terms of bribing local officials? And this bribery took place under Dick Cheney's watch when he was the CEO of Halliburton?
That's an interesting case. I mean, we're hearing a lot about Halliburton's waste and defrauding of the government through their contracts in Iraq, but we're not hearing as much about what happened and what's been discovered by the French prosecutor who started looking into this case, which is that apparently, and we don't know all the details yet because it hasn't been fully vetted publicly, apparently, though, under Dick Cheney's watch and probably extending before and after, as much as $180 million were channeled through a layered kind of structured offshore financing arrangement where you have secret bank accounts and subsidiaries, et cetera, to government officials under the military dictatorship of Nigeria, associated with a natural gas project that Halliburton was leading a consortium to develop. So it's a complicated case. If the SEC and Justice Department are investigating it, the question is, why is this not, given that there's obvious interest that the vice president may have in this case, and in fact the French prosecutor has said that he may want to subpoena him to ask him some questions, then it seems to me that they should impanel a grand jury and have that grand jury working with either the French and Nigerian governments, and as well perhaps Interpol, and insulate it from the kinds of political pressures that you might expect coming from either the vice president's office or elsewhere.
Well, I'm just trying to focus here, Charles Cray, on the insider trading in terms of the American Treasury. I mean, here you have $100 billion of taxpayers' money going to Halliburton and other contractors in this war in Iraq and to a lesser extent in Colombia. You have people on the Defense Policy Board like Richard Pearl getting, $725,000 to help Global Crossing navigate their way through the Pentagon. It seems to me that all of these connected people in this administration are able to make fortunes. I mean, Halliburton is making more money out of this war than anybody.
Well, this brings up an interesting, if you want to contrast that with Martha Stewart, the fact is that under the law we have a federal acquisitions rule that allows you to suspend or debar companies with a history of what they call bad character or not meeting the good character standards, i.e., repeat felons, repeat companies that are recidivist in their criminal or law-breaking behavior. And Halliburton, as you recall, was one of the companies that under Dick Cheney's watch allegedly cooked the books, and that case is yet to be settled. Now, when we first heard about Enron and Arthur Andersen cooking the books and shredding documents, before anybody convicted them, the General Services Administration suspended them from all federal contracts. So they weren't even they didn't have to be convicted. It was just widely recognized that you don't want bad companies getting taxpayer money. Now, here we have a company known as Halliburton, widely connected to the vice president's office, with a whole history of all sorts of allegations, bribery of Nigerian officials, not just the case we just discussed, but there were another case where they admitted that two employees had done this for tax advantage purposes, doing business with the government of Iran through offshore subsidiaries, a government that the administration has called a member of its so-called axis of evil, doing business also with odious regimes like Libya and Burma. The list goes on and on, not to mention all the things like kickbacks associated with the Iraq contracts, overcharging for gasoline contracts, charging the military for meals that were never served. Similar charges were raised in the Balkans war before nobody blinked an eye and gave them the primary contract for the Iraq war. Built-in subsidies to the company in the form of cost-plus contracts. I mean, this is just we're going after these single individuals and not looking at the systemic nature of the problem.
Well, but it does seem, though, that if you're politically connected, not only can you make a fortune, the rules are much relaxed, and if you do get caught, as the case of Kenny Boy Lay, he hasn't done any time and he's not been indicted. Some of his subordinates have, but he is the poster girl. You know, this woman who unlike the president, who was favored by his father and other his father's cronies, was able to have a career as a total failure, but come out with $17 million for the Texas Rangers. And here's a hard-working woman who has literally built her own company for herself. I don't know, I just find it the proportionality somewhat obscene here. You know, as you point out, she did break the law, and she had stupid lawyers, one of whom I believe is her daughter's husband, her son-in-law. Obviously, she should have gone to the SEC in the first place and told them the truth, and it would have gone away, but I guess that's the old Watergate lesson, right? The cover-up's worse than the crime.
Yeah, maybe.
I thank you very much for joining us.
Sure, thanks for having me on.
Thanks a lot, Charles.
All right.
Bye-bye. Hello again, I'm Ian Masters. I'm speaking then with Charles Cray, who's a policy analyst and the director of the Center for Corporate Policy in Washington, D.C. I'm now speaking with Husseina Khani, who's a leading journalist, diplomat, and a former advisor to Pakistani Prime Ministers Jatoy Nawaz Sharif and Benazir Bhutto. And from 1992 to 1993, he was Pakistan's ambassador to Sri Lanka. And you were quoted in the current issue of The New Yorker, an article by Seymour Hersh, Hussein, saying that you felt that that what AQ Khan did was extraordinary and beyond, you know, completely beyond the pale. But in terms of what that article of Cy Hersh's was suggesting, is he was implying that there's a deal being made here where the Bush administration will turn a blind eye to the nuclear proliferation coming out of Pakistan. As long as Musharraf delivers Osama bin Laden. I mean, first of all, how can you guarantee the delivery of Osama bin Laden?
Well, Ian, no one can guarantee the delivery of Osama bin Laden. I have been telling some friends that in the 1930s, there was a terrorist or alleged terrorist leader by the name of the Fakir of Ipi, and the British tried to get him in exactly the same area where the Pakistanis say they are looking for Osama bin Laden right now on the border with Afghanistan. And, of course, it took them about 15 years, and they still couldn't find the man. They bombed the hell out of the place. They thought they had great intelligence, and they were, of course, technologically very superior to the natives at the time. Things have changed, of course. The U.S. has much better technology. It has troops on the Afghan side of the border. And Pakistan is receiving tremendous American assistance, economic as well as military. But there is no guarantee that Osama bin Laden will be found.
And in terms of what the former head of the ISI says in that article, General Hamid Ghul, who's apparently pretty sympathetic to both the Taliban and the fundamentalists in Pakistan who are opposed to the prime minister, I mean to the current military leader Musharraf, he's basically saying if the American troops have too much of a footprint, there's going to be a tremendous backlash. What's your feeling about how delicate that situation is in terms of American footprints on the ground in Pakistan?
Well, the tribal areas of Pakistan, of course, have had their quasi-autonomous status primarily because these tribes have a long history of not wanting anybody else to run their lives. And so in that sense, they have traditionally not wanted troops of Pakistan, and before that, the British come in. They, in fact, massacred the British, which is what prompted the British to sign the treaties, as a result of which they were declared self-administered tribal areas, and Pakistan has retained those treaties. It would be a violation in certain cases of these treaty obligations towards the tribal chiefs, and we do not know what their reaction will be. They will certainly turn more hostile to the Pakistani authorities, and the Pakistani authorities may have to deal with the fallout long after the search for Osama bin Laden is over and the Americans have left the area.
Now, are the Americans, the special forces that are there, and apparently there was some cross-border activity just this last week, are they are the Pakistani troops there, the Punjabis, any better equipped to deal with these autonomous tribal regions in terms of...
I think that the only advantage that the Pakistanis have is that they have religious similarity with these people, and basically Pakistan has been providing a lot of advantages to the tribal populations in terms of bringing roads to them, electricity to them, as well as providing them with business opportunities in the rest of Pakistan. So in that sense, the Pakistanis are at least looked upon as close cousins or friends or people of the same country, more or less, despite the ethnic and linguistic differences, whereas the Americans are looked upon as total outsiders. And because these people are so insulated from the rest of the world, they don't like anybody who comes from outside, Pakistanis included, but they are more likely to look upon Americans as truly, truly non-believers from a totally different world. And as far as their simplistic worldview is concerned, these are people who are out to change their religion, their lifestyle and everything.
Well, Hussein Haqqani, just in terms of the premise of Cy Hirsch's article in which you're quoted here, you're talking about A.Q. Khan, and once they had the bomb, they had a shopping list of what to buy and where. A.Q. Khan can bring a plain piece of paper and show me how to get it done in the country's people, telephone numbers. This is a guy in Russia who can get you small quantities of enriched uranium. You in Malaysia and a manufacturer of this stuff, here's who will miniaturize the warhead, and then you can go to North Korea and get the damn missile. So clearly, I take it from your quotes here that you're skeptical of the official government denial, that is, that A.Q. Khan was operating entirely as a freelancer.
Well, nobody, including President Bush and everybody else in the U.S. administration, actually believes it, even though they are willing to give it a shot. And I don't think General Musharraf believes it either, because he certainly knows otherwise. The fact remains that nuclear scientists are considered very important assets of a country like Pakistan, which has over the years thought of nuclear weapons as its great deterrent against the possibility of India running it over. And if the nuclear scientists are such great assets, you protect them. You protect them from foreign agents who may be out to kill them. You try to protect them from being kidnapped. You always have security agents around them. And even though Pakistan is not like any of the Middle Eastern authoritarian regimes, or for that matter, like the former Soviet Union, still, Pakistan's intelligence service is a very sensitive intelligence service. It watches people, it watches their movements, it has always managed to change the course of Pakistan's domestic politics. So it's just implausible that somebody could actually trade in something as sensitive as nuclear materials and nuclear designs without anybody getting any hint whatsoever. Moreover, the American government has been telling Pakistani authorities for many years of whatever little it found out. For example, the Americans had no clue about the trade-offs with the Libyans, but they did pick up vibes of trades with North Korea. And the reason is very simple. North Korea is not on the normal tourist travel route. I mean, no one goes to North Korea unless they have business there. So if a Pakistani nuclear scientist shows up in North Korea, the Americans or everybody else wonders, why are they here? It's not for sightseeing. It's not for shopping. It's not for lying around on the beach. There must be some reason. And when Pakistan started developing its missile program with North Korean assistance, then it became very obvious that there was some kind of cooperation in the missile sphere. Now, whether that extended to the nuclear sphere or not is what these revelations are about. And the more the revelations come, the less I am convinced that this could only have been a handful of scientists doing it only to pocket some financial gains.
So in terms of the deal, the notion that Musharraf, you bring us bin Laden and all is forgiven. I mean, basically, is there anything that the Americans can do any right now? I mean, the barn door is open, the horse is bolted.
Well, Ian, what they can do, of course, is to try and get the Pakistanis to share in detail the intelligence, to allow American officials to debrief the Pakistani scientists to the extent of their proliferation activities. Now, I understand Pakistan needs the nuclear deterrent. It has developed it. It's tested it. There's no way that Pakistan is going to roll back its nuclear program, and it should not be asked to. But at the same time, Pakistan can be expected to provide, to join some kind of an international regime for control of trade in nuclear materials in the future. And for that reason, it has to give a full inventory and an accounting of every trade that has taken place in the past. As far as the deal is concerned, of course, that's Cy Hirsch's formulation, not mine, so I do not know the details of it. The only thing I would say is that in the past also, the U.S. has often tended, in the case of Pakistan, because of its strategic location, to gloss over many things, whether it's human rights violations within Pakistan, whether it's the ascendancy of the military, whether it's the development of nuclear weapons, or whether it's the support for Islamic militants. The U.S. has tended to ignore those for whatever is the immediate concern that it has with Pakistan's military and intelligence leadership. And right now, the immediate concern is the pursuit of bin Laden. My view is that while the pursuit of bin Laden is very important and the U.S. should certainly gain whatever cooperation they can from the Pakistani authorities, we should not overlook other aspects, because all of them are areas that will come back to haunt the United States as well as world peace in the future.
Well, it would seem that in the overall scheme of things, Pakistan is a far more important strategic position in terms of the United States than Iraq, for example, or even Afghanistan. And there's some questions about having all your eggs in the one basket vis-a-vis Musharraf, and there've been a number of assassination attempts on his life. It's just,
Ian, you must remember the last time the U.S. had all its eggs in one basket in to such an extent was with the Shah of Iran, and we know all that happened afterwards.
Mm-hmm.
I think the U.S. needs to have, first of all, the U.S. does not have a Pakistan policy. What the U.S. has is a policy against terrorism, global war against terrorism, and in that Pakistan fits in as one of the players. Similarly, during the Cold War, the U.S. had a policy towards the Soviet Union, and Pakistan fitted in it because of its location. It was a great spying station. It was a place from where the U-2s could fly over the Soviet Union. So the U.S. has always taken advantage of Pakistan's strategic location, and Pakistan's military and intelligence community has tended to let it take advantage in return for certain advantages for themselves. The fact is that the U.S. needs to engage Pakistan on a sustained and long-term basis and develop a policy towards it. It's a country which has tremendous internal failures, partly because of the military's domination. It has an economy that is not really functioning that well. 31% of the people live below the international poverty line of living on less than $1 a day. Another 20% are just above the poverty line, which means more than half the population lives in poverty. And that is not the kind of place that you want to let boil in its own stew, and you really need to pay attention to it. And I think it is not the kind of attention the attention does not mean you say, this guy, he's going to be the savior. What if he slips in the bathroom and breaks his, spinal cord, God forbid? I mean, it could be 100 things. Forget about just the assassination attempts. You can have an attitude saying, oh, well, we'll give him the best kind of technical protection and we'll give him the best guard. But people do die, and people do fail domestically in gaining or retaining political support. And I don't think a strategically placed country like Pakistan should actually be ignored in terms of specific policy just because you have a guy who's willing to do business with you in the one concern that you think is important to you right now, which is getting Osama bin Laden.
Well, but it's difficult, though, for me to understand here whether, I mean, how much central control is there? If, for example, I had General Firouz Khan on a couple of weeks ago, and just at the time of the AQ Khan story breaking, and he, of course, was the number two in the nuclear chain of command, and he's pretty intimate both with the nuclear arsenal and with AQ Khan, and he felt that that AQ Khan's activities were completely inexplicable and against the national interest of Pakistan, particularly dealing with Iran. Now, the dealings with North Korea are pretty, there's the reciprocity there in terms of nuclear of missiles in exchange for enrichment cyclotrons, you know. So give me just a sense of whether indeed it could be true that I mean, we've got through saying that nobody believes that the guy was selling stuff out the back door without somebody knowing about it. But on the other hand, it does seem, at least from a senior military officer's point of view, that AQ Khan's activities were against the national interests of the state. So it makes you wonder, are there states within a state here?
There are several states within the state. The Islamists have their own agenda. The certain intelligence officers have their own. And the fact of the matter is that when the military basically overthrows civilian regimes on the average of once every 3 years, essentially it's a country in which there is no accountability and transparency, and there is no constitutional change of governance. So every individual and every leader, for example, the military. I mean, look, before 9/11, General Musharraf's point of view was supporting the Taliban was in Pakistan's interest. After 9/11, he changed his opinion. So one man's opinion, and now, of course, everybody forgets about what he did before 9/11, because that's the way we are. We all tend to forget. But the fact remains that you can actually have a general who may think at a certain time, and I think that's how it happened. This is a speculation on my part, but I'm sure that there were generals at some point in Pakistan's history who thought, well, Iran and China are very crucial friends, and maybe if we allow Iran to develop a kind of a nuclear deterrent, that would be good for Pakistan. Although to me it doesn't make any sense to give nuclear weapons capability to your next door neighbor when you're already threatened on the other side by a nuclear power, which is India. People do not have, if national interest is not formulated through open debate, individuals can allow their warped views to prevail, and I think that's what's been happening in Pakistan.
Well, just in closing then, you're quoted here as saying that these are the sort of priorities here. One, screw India. Two, deceive America. Three, expand Pakistan's influence in the Islamic community. And four, continue to spread nuclear weapons technology. And then you say, Musharraf is trying to put out the fire with the help of the people who started the fire. The idea that the Americans are being suckers is not a very comforting idea here.
Well, but the fact remains that during the Cold War, the Americans were suckered in the sense that they thought they were arming Pakistan to fight communism, whereas Pakistan was arming itself to fight the Indians. Then, in the anti-Soviet phase of the war against the Soviets in Afghanistan, the Americans thought they were supporting Pakistan to help fight the Soviets in Afghanistan, which they did, and did very well. But at the same time, the Pakistan were using that to build up their capacity to be able to pursue their battle with India again. And now, again, the Americans, and by the way, the Americans are not stupid. I mean, the American decision makers don't do it because they don't know it. They just think that that the price that the U.S. will pay is minor. My view is that it isn't. That, for example, by ignoring some Americans that remained in the region after the Soviets left Afghanistan was the reason why we ended up with Bin Laden becoming what he became, the Taliban rising to power. I think that when you light a fire, and California's probably know this well, if you light a fire, you have to put it out and make sure there are no embers out there that will then catch fire on their own. And I think sometimes American decision makers do not think on those terms in dealing with states like Pakistan.
Well, I'm sorry that the cell phone's breaking up there. So I think just to summarize, you're saying that that they basically gave too much rope and too much money to. I take it you're referring to the ISI, the intelligence agency.
And
the tail has been wagging the dog here for a while. And
instead of Pakistan becoming a stable country under democracy and under rule of law, Pakistan has become a country with several sectors of power, which does not suit Pakistan, and we have now learned it does not suit the United States.
I thank you very much for joining us, Hussein Haqqani.
A pleasure talking to you, Ian.
Thank you. Bye-bye. Hello again, I'm Ian Masters. Just speaking then with Hussein Haqqani, who's a leading journalist, diplomat, and former advisors to Pakistani Prime Ministers Nawaz Sharif and Benazir Bhutto. And I'm now speaking with Dr. Robert Maguire, who's the Director of Programs in International Affairs at Trinity College. He's formerly was a Peace Corps volunteer and then was with the Department of State for a number of years and has become a specialist in Haiti. He's traveled to Haiti at least 100 times and is fluent in Creole. And you testified this week before a House committee. You're on a panel that followed Roger Noriega, the Assistant Secretary of State, who used to work for Jesse Helms and who's pretty much the point man on the Haiti policy. And there were a number of members of the Black Caucus there as well. The anger from the members of the Black Caucus is quite palpable, and the arrogance also of Noriega and the administration is equally palpable. So what was your feeling there being in the hearing room?
Yes, well, Ian, my feeling of being in that hearing room was exactly the way you've described it. The emotions were raw and they were running high. I would say there were at one point 17 Democrats and about 5 Republicans, and the Democrats were comprised principally of members of the Black Caucus. There were about 12 of them there, but even non-Black Caucus members of the Democrats who were there were outraged by the seeming arrogance of the administration spokesman, Mr. Noriega, in trying to defend what the policy toward Haiti has been.
Well, it's pretty hard to understand how you could have had this situation get to the point it did, and that Noriega and people are saying, well, you know, we couldn't do anything to help Aristide because it was too, you know, the rebels were on their way. I mean, surely, if the U.S. really cared about democracy in that part of the world, the rebels wouldn't have been able to cross the border and do what they did.
Well, absolutely. I mean, I think, you know, there's an expression that you hear a lot in Washington in times like this over a controversial policy, that is a wink and a nod. I think that there have been winks and nods going out from Washington for a number of years now toward Mr. Aristide's opponents, particularly the civilian ones in the capital city. But nevertheless, it's very hard to understand how there managed to be commandos training in the Dominican Republic under the watchful eye, I'm sure, of both Dominican and American authorities. Mr. Philippe, the now kind of well-publicized leader of these rebels, and of course journalists are trying to romanticize him a little bit, I think quite unfortunately, as a handsome young man. But he is the mastermind, allegedly, behind some violence that has been occurring both in Haiti and along the Dominican-Haitian border for the past number of years, including in December 2001, a commando attack on the National Palace in the middle of the night, where I think about a dozen police officers, Haitian police officers, were murdered. So it is quite astounding. And one of the members of the Black Caucus, Congressman Payne from New Jersey, he raised the issue of the fact that there were apparently 20,000 weapons shipped into the Dominican Republic by the United States to the Dominican military to ostensibly reinforce their capacity to control issues like drug dealing. And there is frankly quite a bit of wondering whether or not some of the weapons that the rebels have been seen brandishing are in fact some of these come from the stack of supply of 20,000.
Well, it's just fairly clear that this was a none of this happened by accident. That when the administration say that basically there was nothing they could do to save Aristide from the rebels, I mean, yeah, it's just nonsense, because they clearly allowed this situation to get to the point. But you've been there a lot, and you know pretty much the inside story here, that they were essentially strangling this guy from day one. I mean, he was elected in 1990. He was booted out by the mm-hmm. the military thugs, and then the U.S. Invaded. A deal was brokered by Colin Powell, Jimmy Carter, and Senator Sam Nunn to restore Aristide. And then, just pick us up from there, then, from the point
where... Well, you know, to coin a term, I would say this has been a kind of a low-intensity coup d'etat. You're right that Aristide was restored under the Clinton administration. But even at that time, there were very important Republican voices in Washington who did not support that action. And once the House of Representatives went over to the Republicans in November of 1994, Clinton's policies and programs to help Aristide were increasingly put under scrutiny, with all kind of conditions applied to them, congressional holds on funding. I mean, in one of the most cynical and ironical actions that occurred while I was on the scene in the State Department, in the year 2000, Mr. Helms managed to put a hold on election support, election observation assistance to the OAS that was going to come from the U.S. And then, of course, after the elections, he criticized the OAS for not having a strong enough role in observing them.
And Roger Noriega was working for Helms.
Oh, yes, yeah. Yes. Mr. Noriega was on Mr. Helms' staff until the Bush administration got elected. And then from there, he became the U.S. ambassador to the OAS for about the first 2 years of the Bush administration. And from that position, you know, he was able to be very highly critical of the government of Mr. Aristide. And while, you know, while our policy was one of strong criticism, it was also one of isolating the Aristide government by cutting off international support. Now, Ian, the irony of all this is that, you know, Mr. Aristide, in many respects, wounded himself because of some of bad decisions. And one of the things I'm trying to sort out is, you know, where is the cart and the horse in all of this? Because I think as Mr. Aristide was kind of backed more and more into a corner by these policies and practices.
Well, these are policies of strangulation.
Yeah, exactly. But, you know, as he was backed more and more into a corner, I think he became more and more desperate as his maneuvering space kind of shrank. And instead of managing, being able to manage programs and resources and move the country forward, he ended up being only able to manage power, which I think drove him deeper and deeper or closer and closer to the street thugs. And without resources available, made his government more vulnerable to the authority and power of various people in terms of doing contraband in the country, and specifically drugs as well. So it's really been a tragic scenario, and I think it's almost like the U.S. policy has been looking at Haiti through the wrong end of a telescope for the past 3 years, just looking exclusively at Mr. Aristide. And while doing that, ignoring the rest of the country, ignoring the institutions that had begun to be put in place after following 1994, and enabling essentially a country that is always on the edge of a humanitarian crisis, fall deeper and deeper into that, hurting millions of Haitian citizens along the way.
Just to get rid of this guy that they didn't like, they made these already impoverished people even more desperate. So
I think so.
But isn't there a big, there's a big story to this that, you know, that, I mean, everybody's focused on the neocons in Iraq, and they don't recognize that the entire U.S. government has been populated by radicals, not just in in foreign policy areas, but in the environment and housing, you name it. There's a cadre of angry, extreme right-wing zealots that this is an extreme government we have. We think that that this compassionate conservative he ran as a moderate, but his appointments have been extraordinary, and there's a palpable sense of triumphalism and kind of thuggery here in terms of Noriega and Otto Reich and these people that he's put in charge of they put in charge of Latin America. But I understand that the International Republican Institute is becoming a kind of front, a cutout for these kind of activities, and this is taxpayer money that is going towards these anti-democratic coups. In a sense, I think you can characterize Bush's foreign policy. It's, you know, no matter whether you're democratically elected or not, if we don't like you, we're going to get rid of you. And that applies to Arafat, that applies to Chavez in Venezuela, and clearly it was what happened to Aristide.
Yes, well, just a couple of responses. One is there was absolutely no compassion shown for this administration for Mr. Aristide, and one would argue in their determination to get rid of him, no compassion shown for Haiti, because you look at what Haiti is right now, and it's a degenerated state of thugs and fiefdoms and violence and score settling, and the administration is now kind of trying to support some sort of an ad hoc policy to put some of these genies back in the bottle that shouldn't have been let out in the first place.
Well, you've also got this widespread looting and destruction of property, which is going to set the economy back for years.
Yes, absolutely, absolutely, absolutely. So, you know, I just think that one of the problems with Haiti has been that the administration, there are some solidly good people in the administration. I tend to have a great deal of faith in Mr. Powell, for example, the Secretary of State. But, you know, his plate is very large, and a country like Haiti is very small, and the policy was being run by subordinates with this kind of determined look in their eye just to get rid of one guy. And, you know, nobody's paying a whole lot of attention right now to Haiti's neighbors, the CARICOM countries such as Jamaica and the Bahamas, St. Lucia and so on. But these countries are outraged at what happened. They've asked for a UN investigation into an alleged U.S. aiding and abetting of a coup d'etat. And, you know, it's really sad because our Caribbean neighbors, I think, you know, they're democratic governments. But yet we tend repeatedly just to treat them like, you know, garbage. You look at what the U.S. did in terms of the banana controversy when the U.S. took the European Union to the World Trade Organization because the European Union was subsidizing bananas in the Caribbean to help these industries stay afloat. And, you know, the U.S., and this was both on the Clinton and the Bush administration, you know, under the auspices of free trade, you know, went and attacked this subsidy policy, and as a result, you have some small islands vulnerable now economically because their major economy has been undercut. So it's very sorrowful that we don't really look at our Caribbean neighbors in a way that is more helpful than hindering them.
But what about this idea that that these ideologues? At the deputy level, they've populated the government at the deputy level, which is the key level, that they are basically have a free hand to impose their vision, whether it's having to do with democracy or not. I mean, there's an element of thuggery, and I'm trying to figure out what is the role of the International Republican Institute in this? Because
The International Republican Institute has a very suspicious role in this. It's been mandated by the administration to get funding from USAID to do what they call Democracy Building 101 with civil society groups. But in fact, what has been going on has been a series of meetings, both in the Dominican Republic and in the United States, between some IRI operatives and members of the opposition political parties. And again, I think this is part of that whole thing of wink and nod, you know. I mean, there's a presumption that if the IRI is telling you something, because it's a Republican administration, that what the IRI is telling you is policy. And it seemed that the IRI was telling the opposition groups that they should steadfastly oppose Mr. Aristide, steadfastly refuse to seek a mediated political solution to the crisis that's been brewing in Haiti since 2000. So in that regard, whether the IRI is the policy arm of the administration or not, people in the Caribbean, particularly in Haiti, I mean, they just presumed it was and acted accordingly. And I never saw the administration, Mr. Noriega, for example, speak out about this, never said anything about it. So again, it goes back to that wink and nod. And that's just got to stop.
Well, it was more than a wink and a nod. They gave veto power to the opposition to completely isolate Aristide. And then they, in effect, created the problem that then they said, well, look, you know, you've got a problem. People are trying to kill you. I'm sorry, we can't help you. You've got to go. I mean, the reason people were trying to kill him was that they obviously were given either encouragement or at least immunity.
Yeah, I mean, it's true. And you know, it's quite unfortunate that as Mr. Aristide was pushed more and more into this corner, he just became increasingly kind of desperate to get out of it, and which led to some bad decisions as well. So,
well, this is a travesty in terms of democracy. This is the part of it that scares me and that should scare the American people. And they should be aware of what their government's doing in their name. If you've got these you know, non-governmental organizations that are paid for by the taxpayer, mm-hmm. the IRI. Mm-hmm. I mean, Lucas, the guy that runs it, wasn't he celebrating the night that there was that coup against Chavez a while back?
Well, I'm not sure about that, but what I can tell you is that when I was in Haiti in February 2001 to witness the inauguration of Aristide, the state television was showing a video montage of what the army had done in the past, and in one part of this video montage that they showed General Prosper Avril, who incidentally last Sunday was let out of the National Penitentiary, but he and his uniformed military colleagues were drinking champagne after they had overthrown another general in the late 90s, and there was one person in civilian clothing standing there drinking champagne with them, and it was the fellow you mentioned who ends up eventually as the IRI operative for their Haiti program.
And so is there a kind of a Mountain Jeff deal here with Noriega being the kind of brawn and Otto Reich the brains?
This is the way it starts to seem. I don't know that Mr. Noriega is really the brains behind it, but surely he's been very out front in terms of the person who is speaking the loudest and the strongest against the IRC government and defending the administration's policies. So yes, I would say that sounds kind of like a reasonable conclusion.
And the what has replaced or will replace Aristide, they may have a civilian front, they may be students and others, but the bottom line is that it was the guys with guns that pulled it off. And usually the guys with guns don't give up power that easily if they've...
Absolutely. And, you know, the reports over this weekend have been that the gangs with the guns are saying, you know, well, we're not going to disarm, we're just going to hide our guns. And now the journalists are starting to get out of the capital into the countryside and report some of the reports I saw this morning here in Washington, where those of kind of revenge settling, score settling, all sorts of murder and mayhem occurring. And, you know, in essence, I'm very much afraid that this whole thing is going to go back to the old Haitian practice of politics and that winner takes all, and if you're not with the winner, you're out of here. And, you know, so Haiti's never going to change as long as it goes back and forth into that kind of political equation.
And the winners in this case appear to have been covertly helped by the U.S. Government, this government, or at least agents of its government through the IRI, the International Republic Institute, the possibility that arms, as Congressman Don Payne was saying at the hearing, that arms have been shipped from the U.S. inventory to next door and perhaps ending up with the hands of these guys. There's a lot of questions to be asked. One would hope that the press understands that, you know, remember they fought a war in 1991 against Saddam Hussein. Because he invaded a sovereign country. I mean,
this activity
is not supposed to be what we stand for.
No, I'm very worried, Ian, that the questions will not get answered and we'll kind of move on to the next topic. But frankly, one thing that may keep this alive is the fact that we are in a political election year. I think Mr. Kerry has some suspicion about what was going on here and real concern about how the policy toward Haiti has been run. And the other thing is, you know, Florida is a wedge state in this election, and there are 226,000 Haitians in Florida by the U.S. Census. Many of them are voting citizens who were not happy with what happened in 2000 in the elections. And, you know, Florida, Haiti could stick around as an election issue, particularly in the state of Florida.
I thank you for joining us in Los Angeles, Dr. Robert McGuire.
It's been a pleasure, Ian. Thank you for having me.
Thank you. Bye-bye. Hello again. I'm Ian Masters. You're speaking with Robert McGuire, who's the Director of Programs in International Affairs at Trinity College. He's formerly with the Peace Corps and with the State Department for many years in Haiti, where he's traveled to Haiti at least 100 times and is fluent in Creole.
I thank Louis Vandenberg for the research and producing this program. I thank the engineer, Mark Maxwell.
This program can be heard on ianmasters.org on the net, ianmasters, one word, .org. Bye for now.